Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 9th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. And in honor of the British elections yesterday, changed up the intro song for the day, and it really threw me off.
I like it a lot.
It is
such a great song.
Casual Friday, ladies and gentlemen. You know what that means? On the program today, Cliff Schechter, to look back in the week that was. And also joining us, ostensibly to give us a movie recommendation, Isabel Gillies from New York City. Also on the program today, Labor wins without quite winning. But a big, big night. And I got to say, Mike from Pennsylvania
nailed it.
One of our regular callers in the fun half. Also on the program today, after Comey, Trump knows he owes Ryan and McConnell. And as such, the Senate looks to pass Trump Care in 3 weeks. Parliamentarian has a little bit of a roadblock we will discuss. House Republicans, meanwhile, vote to deregulate Wall Street and gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Meanwhile, Democrats call for an investigation into a growing GOP stock scandal. John Ossoff opens a lead in Georgia 2 weeks out, 10 days out from a primary special election in Georgia's 6th. FDA targets an opioid maker. All that and more on today's program. I want to remember to do this, so I'm going to do this first. We got an email from listener Dave, who says, my son Ryan is turning 16 on June 9th. That would be today. He's a huge fan of the show. Can I get a shout-out shofar for him? It would mean a lot to him. He got a shout-out from Norsey and Mike a while back, and it made his day. He is a great kid that always reminds me to buy my junk from Amazon through the kickback link. Also, he has a Majority Report clan on Battlefield 4. Matt may be able to tell you what that means.
Wow, that's cool.
Well,
awesome. I'm not
nailed
super,
it.
I play Battlefield 1, but
Well,
that's
in
a new
one.
Character called Spoiler Alert Matt.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Ryan, happy birthday. Kid 16 and is a loyal Majority Report supporter.
Assalamu alaikum, young man.
There you go. So let's get right to it. Last night, the Labor Party had its best night, I guess since 1997. I mean, it depends on how you measure this, I guess. But defeating, I should say, and this is a weird, this speech is not only an important speech by Corbyn, but also the UKIP guy behind him, Mao's, I don't know if you know this, Mao's terrorist sympathizer. Yeah. But all right, well, let's hear from Jeremy Corbyn, and we will talk about the details of the election in a bit. But here's Jeremy Corbyn last night.
This election was called
This election was called in order to for the Prime Minister to gain a large majority in order to assert her authority. And the election campaign has gone on for the past 6 weeks. I've travelled the whole country. I've spoken at events and rallies all over the country. And you know what? Politics has changed. And politics isn't going back into the box where it was before. Because what's happened is people have said they've had quite enough of austerity politics. They've had quite enough of cuts in public expenditure, underfunding our health service, underfunding our schools and our education service, and not giving our young people the chance they deserve in our society. And I'm very, very proud of the campaign that my party has run, our manifesto for the many, not the few. And I'm very proud of the results that are coming in all over the country tonight of people voting for hope, voting for hope for the future and turning their backs on austerity. And so, if there is a message from tonight's result is this. The Prime Minister called the election because she wanted a mandate. Well, the mandate she's got is lost Conservative seats, lost votes, lost support and lost confidence. I would have thought that's enough to go, actually, and make way for a government that will be truly representative of all of the people of this country. And so, we await the rest of the results. But I can assure you of this, in the new Parliament, we will do everything we can to ensure that everything we've said in this campaign and everything that's included in our manifesto is put before Parliament so that this country can be a different and, I believe, fundamentally better place.
So there you have it. The Conservative Party loses 12 seats, I think. I think these are the updated numbers. Labour won 29 seats or 31?
I read 31 as the latest update.
Okay. We'll
double check.
My list here. The SNP lost 21 seats. Liberal Democrats picked up 4. Democratic Unionist Party picked up 2. Sinn Féin picked up 3. And Sinn Féin's interesting. They will not seat those members. So there are 7, I guess, seats that are basically empty.
And if they did, they're a left party. So, you know, that would support the left.
Indeed. There's many other parties that go down the list, but UKIP lost its seat. The Social Democratic and Labour Party lost, I guess, 3 seats. Ulsterist Unionist Party. However, my understanding is that the Tories will form a government with what is it? DUP? Is that what is it? DUP.
Democratic Unionist Party.
And which is, I guess, the functional equivalent of the moral majority, I guess, in this country. Anti-abortion, creationists, and also apparently rather friendly with folks like the Red Hand Commando, which is a Ulster loyalist paramilitary group. Not necessarily in the Ulster Freedom Fighters. They are almost like hyper pro Brexit. But my understanding is that they're in favor of Brexit simply because they don't want Ireland in a different class relative to the EU than the rest of Britain.
Let's also just savor the irony that, yes, it's a group with, just like, you know, Sinn Féin's the political arm of IRA and now has turned into a kind of social democratic party. But, you know, Theresa May ran the whole campaign and all of the right-wing press and all of these assholes were running around calling Jeremy Corbyn a terrorist sympathizer. And now her whole coalition is propped by a party that's quite literally in bed.
At the beginning of that clip, you can see the UKIP guy saying that. I think it's a UKIP guy. Someone,
I think it's
the guy,
a UKIP guy too. Yeah,
he mouthed terrorist sympathizer. So, and now they actually are in league with nearly, I mean...
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a party that...
You can see. I mean, it was just the clip that you just showed. But it's right at the head of it. And there's a close-up. All right, well, before we get to Cliff, just want to remind you, we are now officially 10 days out. You got about a week and a half, folks, for the perfect Father's Day gift. Do not wait any longer. Now is the time to do this. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99, you can get my limited time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my secret code REPORT in the search bar. That's 80% off. Let me tell you what you get. This is for less than $50. I mean, one penny less. $49.99, two filet mignons, two top sirloins, four chicken fried steaks, four boneless pork chops, four burgers, four jumbo franks, a 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 1 pound of fries, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional burgers free. All of this for less than $50. This is turnkey barbecue stuff for a big crowd. Family reunion, Father's Day. If you're looking for a convenient and quick Father's Day gift, go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT in the search bar, and add the family gift pack to your cart. Get an 80% savings. Grab your dad. Fire up the grill.
Hey, Dad. Let's fire up the grill.
I mean, let's face it. Your dad is, you know, the classic. You go and you're firing up the grill anyway, so you don't need to grab anybody.
I'll grab you by the goddamn lapel. I want Franks.
They let you do that.
They let you do that when
grab
you're broadcasting. Did you see what IIM'd you? people are such jerks. I love it.
They want me to try and pronounce played in Zimru. Yeah, no. I saw those, and I was just like, not even gonna try. All right, we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Casual Friday, but there's nothing casual about these weeks anymore, is there? I mean, even on Friday, it's not casual. We got to get to it, ladies and gentlemen. But before we do any of it, this has to happen.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, Cliff Schechter, you know, gone are the days where we can really stretch out and we have no news to cover the prior week. Welcome to the program, Cliff.
Why, thank you. Yeah. No stretching out like we could in the past. It's a bit of a more serious situation.
All right. Well,
of course, we still have to have fun with the fact that we could all disappear at any time.
Indeed.
Because who wouldn't?
all right. Well, look, let's start. We did a lot of coverage on Comey yesterday, but give me your take, I guess, as to where we are now.
Well, you know, look, we're still dealing with a House of Representatives. I mean, in the end, for there to be any kind of impeachment, if that's what we're talking about, or pressure for along those lines for our president to resign, we still need, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate to act like they actually have our constitutional officers, you know, of a republic. They've been elected to carry out constitutional duties and not have people like Paul Ryan saying, oh, you know, Trump probably just didn't know what he was doing was wrong. And John McCain going into apparent senility while he was questioning Comey, and Marco Rubio doing his best little Marco impression.
Let's do we have that clip of John McCain? Okay, we're going to find that clip of John McCain, but because that was pretty stunning.
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, I don't know what he had, you know, like, you just have to sort of sit there and question and be like, what were those, you know, when I wrote the book I wrote on John McCain way back when, the one thing I considered to be something that you had to almost consider sacrosanct, you know, were some of the swift boat type or, you know, types who went after John McCain in 2000 trying to say he was a Manchurian candidate. Little did we know about that, what would happen along those lines. But you know, and I would always say, I mean, this is a guy who suffered through torture for years, you know, for his country and for his men who he served with. And he's just, even more than someone like Rosenstein and some of these other guys that are throwing away their reputations and everything, what he's done in terms of first cowing to the Bush administration and everything, but now to protect a guy who's this obviously guilty of as many things as Donald Trump is guilty of. And I mean, it's sort of like it erases all the good that John McCain ever did.
Well, all right, let's play this clip. I mean, this clip, there's two things that are happening with this clip. One is, as you say, John McCain is shilling hard for Donald Trump. And that this is a good predicate for what we're going to be talking about in a few moments in terms of healthcare and Dodd-Frank. But not only is he shilling for Donald Trump hard, he is also having a moment significant enough that former Congressman John Dingell on Twitter, as John McCain was up there, tweeted out, you know, sometimes the best thing is just to take a nap. And and after, well, let's play this clip. This is John McCain getting lost in his own attempt to spin some type of to muddy the waters in some way for Comey, but he's in such muddied waters himself, he can't seem to see which direction he's headed in.
We don't have to worry about it anymore.
With respect to I'm a little confused, Senator. With respect to Secretary Clinton,
yeah,
we investigated criminal investigation in connection with her use of a personal email server.
I understand.
And that's the investigation I announced inclusion of on July 5th.
So, but at the same time, you made the announcement there would be no charges brought against then Secretary Clinton for any activities involved in the Russia involvement in our engagement in our election. I don't quite understand how you could be done with that, but not complete done with the whole investigation of their attempt to affect the outcome of our election.
No, I'm sorry. We're not, at least when I left, when I was fired on May the 9th, there was still an open, active investigation to understand the Russian efforts and whether any Americans work with them.
But you reached the conclusion that there was no reason to bring charges against Secretary Clinton. So you reached a conclusion. In the case of Mr. Comey, case of President Trump, you have an ongoing investigation. So you got one candidate who you're done with and another candidate that you have a long way to go. Is that correct?
I don't know how far the FBI has to go, but yes, that the Clinton email investigation was completed. The investigation of Russia's efforts in connection with the election and whether there was any coordination, and if so, with whom, between Russia and the campaign, was ongoing when I left.
It seems like McCain...
He thinks there was a Hillary Clinton investigation around Russia?
He thinks the Hillary Clinton email investigation had to do with the Russian hacking, and which, if he actually believed that, that's super scary, because you couldn't have been paying much attention to not know that those were separate issues.
You know, the thing is that this is one of the many issues. And this one will never be solved, by the way, that we have in our current republic. And one of them is, you know, some people say term limits will solve it. I don't know. But these guys run for the Senate again and again and again. It seems like there's more on the Republican side right now. But we've had them on the Democrat. We had Robert Byrd there. And they're not sentient beings anymore.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry if that's just – they're not in control of their faculties. We get, I'd say politically, lots of things wrong here in the state of Ohio that I'm in. But one thing that we get right is the state Supreme Court. You have to retire at the age of 70. You can't run anymore because you're kind of making some important decisions. Now, granted, they're all a bunch of Republican shills right now, so not like they're making objective decisions anyhow, or most of them are. But it, to me, whether it's a Strom Thurmond being wheeled in or it's Byrd, or I mean, McCain should just not be there anymore. He doesn't know what he's doing, clearly. And I don't have much sympathy for him anymore. He's been an angry codger since he was 14. I mean, you know, so I wrote in my book, his nickname in high school was McNasty. So anybody who thinks that the nasty side of him, where he curses out people that don't agree with him and is temperamental about everything, you know, somehow came from his time in Vietnam, it didn't. I'm sure that made it worse. But with age, as we all know, who've had older relatives, when you get older, it's not the best traits in you that tend to become accentuated, let's just say. And whether it's a John McCain right now or a Chuck Grassley or, yes, a Mitch McConnell, all of whom are in their either well into their 70s, approaching 80, maybe into their 80s, they just shouldn't be there anymore. Beyond the whole other issue I've got with the fact, you know, I don't know if McCain was purposely trying to shell for them, or I don't know if he's just lost his mind, or it's some combination
right.
of both. But he's not serving the republic anymore.
I imagine he was trying to shill, but just wanted a different tack and sort of forgot an important part of what that,
right.
you know, what it was. Like, he knew there was an investigation.
What he wanted to say is, how could you close the Hillary thing on the emails but not close this? I think you're right. He probably was trying to say, what's the difference in trying to catch Comey?
I don't even know. But I guess the bottom line is, that is, aside from the fact that McCain couldn't pull it off, this was the play by the Republicans, which was, let's
yes.
muddy the waters. There are some people who are trying to talk about, you know, that Comey leaked his own memos, which were theoretically, I guess, FBI product, but they were unclassified memos, and they were purposely apparently written in that manner so that he could give them, even though they are work product, to a friend to give to the New York Times. But they're going to make a bunch of that. But I guess what's really more important.
Well, I mean, and they've got their lawyer who can't even spell president right. I mean, that thing put out by Kasowitz just reminds you that Trump, it's hilarious that I only hire the best people. He literally only hires the dumbest people. But I think there's an actual IQ ceiling for being able to work around dumb stuff. You have to be a moron.
To be fair.
That thing he put out there. Yeah.
To be fair, Trump did try to get the top defense lawyers in the country who would be appropriate to address this type of issue, and they all rejected him.
Right. Clearly, they all want to work for a liar who they can't trust, whose own lawyers admitted in deposition at one point that they have to make sure there's two of them in a room with him.
Yep.
Because nobody ever knows what he's going to say to anybody else, because he literally is a pathological liar who can't keep a story straight for more than like 30 seconds. But we should trust him over Comey, of course. And what they're trying to do now, you're right, they're trying to muddy the waters in every way. Again, you know, this is, to me, there's been a lot of things that I would call stunning and shocking and about the Republican Party's devolution over the last 15 or 20 years. But it seems to me now the position of the at least the party in Washington, there are some people out in the states who aren't supporting, who refuse to support Trump. I mean, as much as I detest many of his positions on social issues, John Kasich, to his credit, has refused to do that in this state. But it seems the official, you know, kind of position of the Republican Party in Washington has become treason. I call it treason in the service of partisanship. It doesn't matter. You know, Mitch McConnell would not let them announce jointly that there was an investigation into Trump during the election because he wanted to protect his party.
Right.
And he wanted to make Gorsuch a Supreme Court justice and wanted to make sure all the right people got all the right tax cuts. Paul Ryan shills now and says, you know, and has for a while and pretends that whether Trump understands it or not. No, I'm not sure he understands what he did is as bad as it is either. I don't care. That's not an excuse. He's the president of the United States. Too damn bad. You know, just all of them and the group of jokers. I mean, whether it's personal pride, McCain and Rubio, and which is just cringeworthy how they'll prostrate themselves before Trump after what he said about them. And in Ted Cruz's case, his wife and father. But beyond that, in terms of actually caring about this country, I mean, do any of them care anymore? Do any of them care that we've got somebody that's so unstable sitting there that he will tweet insults to the mayor of London after their city was attacked? I mean, it goes beyond the fact that he's probably unwittingly or wittingly, more likely, an agent of Russia, that Kushner, you know, Flynn and Sessions between them have lied on official forms that are tantamount to perjury or in testimony now about nine or 10 different meetings with the Russians, that Kushner tried to set up a secret back channel, and we can go on and on with all this stuff. We don't need to, because everybody knows it. That, you know, that's bad enough. But the guy that can't keep his damn mouth shut, or at least say something nice after what's supposed to be one of our closest allies is attacked, he's clearly bad for this country in terms of our leadership of the world.
Yes.
He's bad for us economically. He's bad for us in terms of national security. He can't hold a meeting with the Russians in the Oval Office, and that he's having that meeting with them in the Oval Office should be enough, frankly, without telling them classified information that Israel gave to us that undermines our fight against ISIS, or can't go without hiring a national security advisor who undermines our fight against ISIS because Turkey's paying him to. I mean, when does this become ridiculous?
Months ago. And
but
I think, you know, and this is a good place to pivot as well. There's a reason why Paul Ryan is saying these things. There's a reason why Mitch McConnell has nothing to say about this, because in many respects, this is sort of a perfect opportunity for them to do things. And what is becoming clear is, you know, the notion of security and of foreign policy for, you know, as Republican issues are meaningless when compared to the idea of tax cuts. And I mean, honestly, like, this is we are seeing the Republican Party in its most naked form. And
but I'd also add power to that.
I think, look,
which is, they don't want to risk losing power, and they worry about, like, the 1974 Watergate election. They think, you know, where they lost huge numbers of seats, they think they can protect the line. A lot of that's about serving their paymasters. But it's not all about that, only because someone like Mitch McConnell, who's well into his 70s and married into wealth and is now worth something like $40 million, he doesn't need to please anybody anymore or do that. He likes the power. He likes being there and rooting people's lives. Apparently he gets off on that.
And I think there's an ideological, you know, these tax cuts are not just about putting more money in their pockets. There's an ideological belief that, you know, you don't want certain types of people to be in any way helped by government. And you don't want government to help people. That's just not the role of government. I mean, this is a fundamental ideological disagreement here. And perspective. And now, you know, we heard Mitch McConnell has figured out that after watching what took place in the House, that the best way for him to get health care passed through the Senate is to be very, very quiet about it. And, you know, to a certain extent, when we heard, and I was, you know, really skeptical about it 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 1 week ago, when you're hearing, like, it's dead on arrival in the Senate. We're not going to get anything done. We're not close to 50, et cetera, et cetera. The fact that they're starting to get ready to score this with a CBO and that they have pushed this through and the, you know, they're still working things out with the parliamentarian. We can get to that in a second. But it's quite clear that they have the broad outlines of a healthcare bill that they are prepared to pass. And
yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly. The thing that I always felt like was that they would never get away with was the pre-existing condition elimination. And I still think they won't get away with that. But it doesn't help people who are poor and need, you know, and need Medicaid. And what they are trying to do is cut those federal matching funds that were part of Obamacare. And now they're trying to turn that into a 7-year horizon where it's cut. It's kind of like the frog boiling in the pot. Their hope is that nobody notices if they're suddenly losing it little by little.
Yep.
Fewer, or at least fewer people will notice. And so far, it seems like people, you're right, people like Dean Heller and our, you know, the state guy sitting here, you know, Rob Portman, who tries to play the role of a moderate-ish guy when he can, and Shelley Moore Capito, who is from West Virginia, where huge numbers of people are going to be hurt by this. They seem like they're opening up to it, you know? So it's true. It won't be as bad as the House bill. People who, with pre-existing conditions will not end up being hurt to the level that the House bill wanted to. But again, that doesn't help you if you're low income.
Oh, yeah.
Medicaid's what happens.
And look, we know that what comes out of the Senate is one end of basically the playing field where the final bill is going to land, and so I'm quite convinced that the idea was just get to conference and hammer something out, and then we just go back and say, like, this is for all the, whatever, the marbles, folks. This is the way that we get tax cuts. If we don't pass this, we will pass nothing. And you will,
right,
a year from now, have to face your constituents with having passed zero legislation.
That's the judgment. That's the one I think that Mitch McConnell has made, which is they can't face people in the midterms having passed nothing. That something has to pass, and it has to be something that at least looks on the surface acceptable. That's the part where I think they're going to fail, because I just don't think there's anything they can put together that will look acceptable. Even so, I think if they pass it, I still think they're in a lot of trouble. But, you know, their thought is, again, and we've seen some of this happen already, for a while now, their thought is if we can combine taking it to our propaganda outlets, taking it straight to Fox and Breitbart and Rush Limbaugh and the rest, having them push it onto the mainstream media and affect their narrative, so we can, and the mainstream media will keep doing their he said, she said crap and not actually cover stuff honestly. We step into that void with our media, and then we can, then on the other end of the deal, we can suppress enough votes in places where we control everything, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, whatever, that we can hold on to the House.
Yep.
That's you know, and Sinclair can take over however many more stations and infect however many more minds with our lies and garbage. That's the game they're playing here. You know,
and
this thing has approval rating of like dog poop.
And they look, and this is what they know.
Yep.
They know that if they can pass permanent tax reform, in other words, taxes cuts that do not sunset 10 years out, which is the only thing they can do to get by the Byrd rule, and that it will be that much harder down, or they contemplate that it's going to be that much harder down the road, and politically it's going to be a political weapon if there is a need to raise or desire or an attempt to raise taxes going forward. And so I think for them, you know, this is the holy grail, and they can't do the second round of tax cuts unless they do this one first in any meaningful way. They can't do that second round. And I think that's whatever he can cobble together to get into that conference, they know that when it's the last bite at the apple, that people are going to have to vote for it. And there may be a couple of senators, but, you know, none of them, you know, Susan Collins, you know, somehow she's maintained this reputation as being some type of moderate who always votes with the most conservative elements of her party. And
well, who was it who overheard, you know, Rick Santorum sitting on, like, you know, on the Amtrak line? It was somebody who's like a reporter. I don't really feel like it was Josh Marshall, but somebody did and tweeted out that basically what Santorum was saying, I'm sure people can Google this and find this, you know, was on his phone and was like, oh, don't worry, whenever we need her, Susan Collins is there. That's the story of Susan Collins. You need to vote for an extremist lunatic like Gorsuch, she'll be there.
Yep.
Or something like this. She what she'll do is she'll break with you on all the non-important votes. She sits there and calibrates exactly where she can break with the Republican Party, still make sure they get done what they want to get done, and then can walk around portraying herself as a moderate. And you know, look, I think there's some point in this that you're saying, which is if they can make this a permanent tax cut, you know, all these guys, most of whom are millionaires already, but I'm sure just greedy as all hell, and there's never enough money you can have. You know, they can leave Congress whenever they want and probably choose which investment bank to work at for an overinflated salary for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just from an ideological standpoint, in terms of maintaining their jobs, they're still going to get hung with all this. They they're just thinking, like, at least we will deliver tax cuts. And
that's right.
And so
and forget, like, lobbying at this point. You know, they've had a better trail blazed by the Phil Grahams now and Eric Cantors and on the Democratic side, Harold Ford. You know, why make $500,000 or $750,000 or even $1 million as a lobbyist when you can, if you cut taxes enough for the people at the top who are at investment banks, you can go straight to those banks and land yourself $2 million gig.
Right. And we should just tell people, you know, I went over what we know of this bill at this point yesterday, at the end of yesterday's free show. So people can check that out. But there's one point that came up yesterday that it's going to be interesting to see how they get around this. Apparently, the parliamentarian, a woman named Elizabeth McDonough, has flagged language that would bar people from using the refundable tax credits for insurance. And this is how they're going to provide subsidies. Instead of direct subsidies, they're going to do refundable tax credits. And you cannot spend that money on insurance plans. Or you cannot receive that refundable tax credit if you have an insurance plan that covers abortion. And this is basically Hyde Amendment type language.
Uh-huh.
And
well, isn't it the law in New York also that everyone has to include abortion?
Well, you will not be able to get federal subsidies in that instance.
That's right.
But the problem is that the Byrd rule is basically a six-part rule. One of those rules is that you cannot have everything in the bill must be primarily oriented towards affecting the budget as opposed to making policy. And the subsidies, essentially, the refundable tax credits being rescinded because your insurance has abortion as a benefit is not about the budget, the U.S. budget. It's about trying to discourage people from having or prevent people from having abortions. And right. that
so
is
then a, they can we can have more kids and they can take away their welfare benefits so more people can suffer.
Indeed. And that
is a great plan.
That's a violation of the Byrd rule. And so they have got to figure out a way around that because they can't take that language out as it is and still attract the vast majority of Republicans in the Senate because they are, like you say, don't want women to have autonomy over their body. One of the ideas may be to change it to assistance to people who would be eligible for these subsidies, change it from a refundable tax credit and filter the subsidy through some other program where people might be getting support. that already has a Hyde Amendment involved in it. So I don't know. I think they're going to be able to get around that, but people should just be aware that that's going to be a story for a day or two, that they may have a bird rule problem. But the bottom line is people need to call their senators, and you need to tell your friends to call their senators. The general number is 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. And if you live in, like, Tennessee, Lamar Alexander, like you mentioned, Cliff, Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia, Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, Bob Corker, Tom Cotton, Jeff Flake, Corey Gardner, Lindsey Graham, Dean Heller, Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman. These are all targets in terms of people who might be hesitant to vote for this bill. So
is Flake on there?
Flake, yes. Did I not mention Flake?
Okay. Oh, I may have missed it.
Either way. And we'll put this list up on majority.fm. Let's talk about what else happened yesterday. I don't think it's going to pass the Senate, but the House passed a, what are they calling this now? It is...
I don't even know what pile of crap.
They call it the Financial Choice Act.
It's where you get you have the choice to lose all your money because somebody puts together a really cool derivative that nobody understands. Basically it was the repeal of Dodd-Frank, or many parts of Dodd-Frank. I haven't read the whole thing, all of its details, but it definitely took out a lot of the regulations that were Dodd-Frankish.
It'll take out the orderly liquidation authority, so that regulators could ratchet down banks who are on the verge of collapse outside of the FDIC. It would take away the bank regulator's ability to say that certain financial organizations are systemically important, right? So that was basically to say, like, if you are a too big to fail bank, then that means you will get more scrutiny and stricter regulations if you're too big to fail. That's gone under the House bill that passed. The Volcker rule, which basically says you can't involve yourself in speculative investments with your depositors' money. It would also jettison the fiduciary rule, which is that rule where your financial advisor actually has to act in your best interest. They can't pretend.
Why would we have a rule like that?
They can't pretend that they are, but in fact are really basically just, like, you know, car salespeople who have no obligation to do anything except for sell you something. And
the one that Democrats should run on, because I think that's the most easily understandable for people, because everybody's dealt with a used car salesman before.
But the amazing thing is, it's insane. I mean, I don't even think that people understand that that there's a wide swath of retirement advisors out there who don't have to give you advice. I mean, aren't in a position to have to give you advice that's best for you. It's amazing. And then the last part is it would basically gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by getting rid of the Bureau's single director and creating a partisan board of commissioners who would just freeze up the thing and it would also
sit around and smoke cigars and do everything you imagine they would do and not really do anything.
Right. And take away its independent authority, et cetera, et cetera. Now, supposedly this is not going to pass the Senate, but, you know, who knows? I think, you know, Donald Trump and this whole Russia stuff, it's important, but, it is a perfect distraction for, yeah. I mean, because you're not going to hear any of this on the press in the press.
Well, it's incredibly important, this stuff. And again, so is what's going on with Russia. The problem is again, you know, we've got a cable news industry that are a bunch of children, and the same with many other publications that who are so-called mainstream media that can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Theoretically, you really should be able to cover three things that are pretty damn important at the same time, you know, Dodd-Frank, the ACHA, and Russia.
Well, but, let's also, you know,
they only believe in having one thing they scream about constantly.
Well, okay, and that's true. But let's also not let the Democrats off the hook for this. Now, maybe Chuck Schumer is out there, and Nancy Pelosi are out there, and Tom Perez are out there saying, you know, other things, but they've got to figure out a way of breaking through the noise. If that means we're not going to show up in the Senate, we're going to boycott the Senate to get people to pay attention to this Health Care Act, then they've got to do it. If that means we're going to go on some type of, you know, I don't know, half naked bus tour to show that healthcare is, you know, to stealing the shirts off of people's backs or whatever it is.
Not Chuck Schumer though.
Well, yes.
Somebody hopefully with a little more of a,
but my point is that they've got to do something about this. There's a responsibility. And, you know, I want to touch on the UK election here.
Yeah, because maybe they should ask them for advice.
Well, you don't need to ask them. You can watch. You can watch and see what just happened. Corbyn was able to make up a 25% deficit, 24-point deficit. Maybe it was a 21, maybe he made up 22 points, whatever it was. He got more voters out for Labour than they've seen in, I think, at least a decade or two. And they're running on a set of policy proposals. And there was a really interesting tweet thread by Zach Carter, I think it was. Who I think
was going to bring that up because I have it in front of me right now.
All right. Yeah. Tell people about it, because I think this is really important. And the Democrats have to get this message and they have to start going on the offense about policies. But talk about that, because I thought it was really important.
Well, no, it's great stuff. I mean, he talks about here, he sort of compared the situation, what just happened in the UK to the United States. And his point was, you can win over, and I think that's correct, you can win over a lot of new voters, you know, who are part of this so-called, you know, he's referring to them as the aristocracy, and that's the easiest kind of shortcut. You know, they're not all aristocrats in terms of born with vast wealth or whatever, but these are people that make very high incomes. You can win some of them over by extremist shaming the right. Which certainly, you know, we saw a lot of new districts that opened up to Hillary Clinton, and that's very true. At the same time, but there's the authoritarian appeal during these kinds of crises lead people to want to embrace a more populist politics, and obviously, that function was served by the left in England or in the UK in a way that it hasn't been as served here. And it's important to remember the people you're talking to who are hurting and are rebelling against aristocracy, and to be talking to them with policies and leadership and hopefully charisma that will bring them.
Yeah, so, I mean, and I think he's saying too that in the wake of a crisis, the reason why authoritarians are activated is because they are afraid, they are feeling insecure. They are feeling like they have been left by the wayside by the aristocracy, by the, you know, you want to call them the establishment. And the only way to address that is not to to, you know, shame the aristocracy into joining your cause, but it is rather to address those and the sort of general, I guess, emotional response to a financial crisis by saying, we have something to offer you too. We will also take care of you. We're not going to take care of you in the way the authoritarians are, but we're going to take care of you insofar as, like, we recognize it may be hard for you to make ends meet. We recognize that you're worried about paying for your health care. We recognize that it is stressful both, and in some instances impossible, for you to provide proper daycare for your kids.
Right.
I mean, on and on and on.
I understand those needs. He has, and you need to frame it. I mean, he doesn't have that here, but you need to frame it. I will say this as a whole, overall, as a whole program. It can't be a set of disparate policies. I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll do. You need to have call it a message, call it a slogan, call it whatever. You need to let people know that you're going to help them. And then within that overall broader narrative, you have the individual policies that will do that. I mean, I think his two best tweets here in this whole series, numbers 17 and 18, that kind of, he said, anti-authoritarian politicians need to make a clean break with what failed and offer a psychological alternative to authoritarian order. That is incredibly important because people just don't, we have this whole sort of post-enlightenment thing where we think everybody's voting based on reason. They're not. Most of us aren't. That's not how we vote. I wish they were so. But it's a psychological thing. People want stability. They want safety. We're that's who we are as a species.
and you need to give people the sense that you will take care of them. And then here's the next one, the number 18, where he said the best pitch is an expanded social welfare program. And he kind of capitalized and said, I'm on your team and we'll take care of you. That's it. You know, I mean, that may not work in that language here. The I will take care of you and you'll have the right claiming you're a socialist and blah, blah, blah. But it really isn't very hard to kind of
put
together.
But you, I mean, that's the subtext, right? That was the subtext
exactly
of what Donald Trump was saying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And even though he's not a credible messenger for that message, people just wanted to hear the message. And
right. And I think where the mistake is made here, he addresses some of this, but the mistake is made here is to think that people, only people who let's say don't have health care or what we would call quote unquote working class or working poor, whatever you want to say, would respond to that message. Don't think for a second that when the kinds of things that happened, like what happened in 2008, that middle class people and frankly upper middle class people also don't want that message, because nobody feels stable in
right.
a situation
exactly.
like that. You don't feel. I don't care if you're making 250 grand a year. You don't feel stable if you think you might lose your health care. Somebody has cancer and you won't have access to it, because even at 250 grand a year, you're not going to be able to afford that. What it's going to cost. Like, I really do think it can be a message in unison where you talk to everybody. I mean, everybody, but let's say, you know, your Koch brother types, and who the hell cares about talking to them?
Yeah. And again,
and this is,
you know, you're not going to win over the, you know, even close to half of people who voted for Donald Trump in the last election, but you don't need half of the
right.
people.
But what I'm saying,
you just need a small slice.
You know, Sam here, and maybe this is like, you know, maybe this is, I'm not saying this is what Zach's saying. This is what, you know, Carter's saying here. He says a lot of great stuff, but this is what I'm saying. As somebody who's worked in this, you know, in politics for a while and has looked at a lot of polling and all of this, which is we make the mistake of thinking when we talk about populism that we're talking about only a certain group of people, right? And everybody sort of makes this a choice. You have to either talk to the working class or the upper middle class, you know, in the suburbs. You can't. And I think that's a false choice. You can talk to both. Because I don't care, even if you're making, if you're one of these people who's making what most people consider a very solid income, then you're still watching people at the top destroy the economy and get away with it. You're still watching people commit criminal acts. There's a populism there. There's an anger there, you know, for people who sit there who may be doing very well and maybe they're not as radical, you know, and maybe they were okay with the order the way it was before the crisis because they were doing well. But after the crisis, they're sitting there looking at things and saying, this isn't stable. You know what I mean? And it's not a choice. You can put together a message. FDR put together a message and appealed to everybody, except for those few at the very, very top.
Yeah. And
you don't think of it as working class and, you know, versus middle and upper middle and everybody else. Think of it as working middle and upper middle against the few at the top that have fucked, pardon my French, all of us.
And I think really the point is that we're living in a time where people feel insecure and unstable, and you must offer something programmatically and recognize it. I mean, like you said, FDR, Zach Carter mentions this. He says after he says, "I am on your team and we'll take care of you." He says, "I will break the cheating aristocrats who did this to you." FDR used both. And in some respects, you know, Donald Trump, again, not a messenger that I would believe, but I think there was such a yearning for some people to hear that message that they were willing to accept it from just the one guy who was saying it. You know,
this is the stuff from if you've read Drew Weston's books and listened to him speak. And some others who've looked at all this, it's simple. We've told each other over a generation that we learn in stories. And stories have a good guy and a bad guy, and they have somebody who's hurt you, and why you should vote for the good guy because of what they're going to do to help you. And that can be told, you know, you want specifics on the bottom level, but you want it to be tonal at the top. You want the tone to be correct. You want the framing to be correct. I mean, he does say, at some point, again, you know, not to mention Zach Carter's name too many times here, but he, you know, again, in another tweet here, which he's exactly right on, said the policy really does matter, but mostly as a guidepost. Tone and approach is just as important. Corbyn nailed both. Tone and approach is just as important. If you believe somebody is fighting for you, who's going to be on your side, I'll tell you to look no further than Sherrod Brown here in Ohio. I mean, he is one here in a state that is somewhat more conservative, I'd say, by a decent amount than he is, because everybody in this state, he goes out there and he points out who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, and he's going to be on your side. So he wins.
Cliff, great place to wrap it up for this week. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Take care.
Cliff Schechter, everyone. Cliff Schechter. Boop, boop. All right, we're going to take a quick break and get in touch with Isabel Gillies. Do we have a Jimmy Reefcake song today?
Finally, a little bit of anti-Schilling on the show.
It's called The People's Party.
But you hate
the
Jeremy
People's
Corbyn.
Party.
Do you want to use this to? Are you going to call Isabel?
No, let's hear it.
Okay.
Happy Casual Friday, everybody. This is a trigger warning. I am going to reference Jimmy Dore right off the bat, but that's not really what this song's about. It's just a way to get your attention. This song is about draftbernie.org and the People's Party. I like thinking about politics, and I like marijuana. I like the interview Jimmy Dore did with Nick Brana. DraftBernie.org is the place if you think the Democrats are a disgrace and the media deserves a big pie in the face. The People's Party is a party for the whole human race. I beg you to remember that Bernie's an independent, not a Democrat. Bernie should have won because he was the best, and I think it's clear he's still better than the rest. Bernie's not afraid to talk about greed. Bernie's not afraid to legalize weed. He's the only candidate who I thought was cool, although O'Malley still would have been better than you know who. May I never have to say her name again. DraftBernie.org is the place if you think the Democrats are a disgrace and the media deserves a big pie in the face. The People's Party is a party for the whole human race.
Oh, I thought that was very measured.
Very measured. And he hit all of his core brand propositions.
Yeah.
Weed, Jimmy Dore, third parties, Bernie's cool, yep. Weed again, and a subtle rebuke of Hillary Clinton. Yep. But I would
say, Hillary,
I didn't pick up on that.
Hillary's a bitch.
No, but
Bernie,
he was so much more effective because he didn't do that.
Legalize weed, and I'll just write the song next week.
I got to be honest with you, I'm finding a lot of difficulty in disagreeing with any of those statements.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Isabel Gillies. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday, and even though people are probably going back and wanting to watch all of the Comey testimony, even though people are going back and wanting to watch all the DNI and NSA head testimony, there's still got to be room for a movie selection. And who better to give us a streaming video selection for the week than the namesake, the person who inspired the song.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
That is classic Jimmy Reefer cake.
Woo!
Isabel, how are you? It's been so long.
It's been a little longer, I feel. I feel like
it
maybe I was like 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, we missed a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I noticed.
We didn't have Friday shows. I was in Vegas doing a show, and then we were on vacation. And how are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm good. It's June, which is a complicated month. Here's what I was thinking in the car driving out to an eighth grade graduation, and I saw a car full on the West Side Highway. It's a beautiful day here in New York City. It's beautiful. It's like
70 degrees.
June 70s, like woo, and it's been cold and rainy. So I saw this car, and even before I could see who was in it, I felt this positive vibe coming from the car. So like an arm coming out the window, like, you know, like clearly someone was listening to music and keeping the rhythm with their, you know, hand somehow. I was like, wait, what was it
a Bentley?
A car.
What kind of car was it?
No, it was just some bold car, indescript. I was like, what is it? There seems to be something that's coming from there that I like. And I was like, it's fun. People in that car are having fun. Because West Side Highway is very beautiful. It goes along the river. And I thought, why? Why are those people having fun? And then I looked, they were teenagers. It was a car full of older teenagers, not being reckless, just that like windows down, summertime, June, and life is fun for them. And I thought, I used to think that. That's how I used to feel in June. And now I think, what the hell? This is not fun. It's stressful. The world is in chaos. People are graduating. To what? To what end? I mean, it's like dark. June is darkness to the adult.
They might have been on drugs, though.
No, I don't think they were. I don't think they were, Kelly. I think they were just having, honest to God, like that summer, like everything's good, wind in my hair, listening to something good.
School
on the radio.
Is just about to be out. Maybe it's out.
They could have been going to get drugs.
Kelly is projecting a little bit about her teenage years. It's not cynicism. It's just her only frame of reference when she hears about teenagers.
Sorry.
But
I know. But like foot out, you know, I used to put my foot in the crook of the window where the mirror is and listen to Grateful Dead. I don't know. It's just like, and I said to my husband, I don't feel like that anymore.
Well, it's because you are fully aware of what's going on in this country, in the world. Yes.
Correct. Although I'll tell you, everybody. So yesterday I was like, what kind of burrito should I make? Breakfast burritos to watch Comey, blah, blah, blah. I've been thinking about it for weeks. And then I had scheduled an appointment that I couldn't get out of at 10
what?
O'clock.
No.
Yes. And I couldn't. And then I had another thing and another thing, and I didn't end up watching it. But this is what happened. No, I mean, I've watched it in segments and stuff. But what kept happening is that all my girlfriends in their, you know, early 50s, late 40s, I kept getting texts about, oh, this is happening, that's happening. And oh my gosh, he's so attractive.
It's
like all these middle-aged women all over New York, like, get on top of me, Comey.
Oh my God.
So
what?
Attractive. Isn't that crazy?
Drugs.
Or that's drugs?
That's disgusting.
Wow.
Jesus.
How did that?
As a palate cleanser, Isabel, it's really disturbing.
That's really. So all your friends are turning James Comey into a sex symbol?
Yeah, that's what I was
Oh, Lordy, what's up,
as
ladies?
I was around the city. I was like, what is he saying? That is everybody's like, oh, my God, James Comey.
Oh, my God.
Like he was, you know, like
I don't know, like a matinee idol or something.
Wow. Well, I mean, I suppose that's good insofar as people wanting to give him some measure of credibility, right? I mean, I suppose it's good in that regard. I wonder, I'm a little bit beside myself because it never occurred to me that that could be that kind of reaction.
It didn't occur to me either, but I guess I could see it.
Oh,
although
God.
My personal preference
is... You can see Obama
is
for sure,
six,
right?
That, people that are 6'8". Oh, yeah. But,
I can see Obama being some type of sex symbol.
But 6'8 is very tall, and it's just like
Well, but he's sitting down. That's the thing. People don't realize how sort of gangly he is and goofy. But
the way you talk about the FBI, if you're thinking about he immediately came to the defense, and he also addressed the FBI directly, right? So he's saying, yeah, "I'm sorry, I didn't get to say goodbye," and all of a sudden, and he's holding it up to the light so we can see what for the good institution it is. And I think maybe you project like honor. He's talking with honor. He's making sense. He's using full sentences. He seems that he's got a moral compass. Whatever you want to say, that's what it sounds like. And I think women are turned on by that.
I think it speaks also just to the desperation that exists in society today for really like anybody who may be able to damage Donald Trump in some fashion.
Right.
I mean, I feel like
yes,
there is this sort of feeling of just mass abuse in some way of this guy. And it's funny because
yes, I think you're right.
And I think there's so much sort of like just put on this guy's shoulders, which is also interesting because what really became clear during the or at least it was tried to be portrayed that he was too cowardly, I don't know, maybe this is an overstatement, to say to Donald Trump, "Hey, man, this isn't appropriate."
He said that himself. He said, "If I could do, if maybe I was, I don't think he used cowardly, but he said that of himself. He said, "I like wasn't brave enough, or I didn't do the right thing to say in that moment."
Yes,
this is completely wrong. And if I could do it again, which of course I can't, but if I could, I would have said that. He blamed himself.
Yeah,
but
that,
it's hard. That's a hard, you know.
I wonder if he, you know, and here's the thing is like, I wonder if he didn't say that. I mean, although he did go to Sessions and tell Sessions, but I wonder if he didn't say that because he was like, maybe this could be interesting and we'll get more. Maybe, you know, this is part of his investigation. It's hard to know.
Just be quiet. Yeah.
It's hard.
Well, he's so smart, right?
Well,
he is so smart.
I mean,
he might have had that kind of chess player, strategical, because you know I'm minute to minute. I can't think 5 minutes ahead. If I in a, like in an argument or I'm not a strategic person. I go on impulse and with my gut and heart and all that, which is why I don't run anything. But he might have, you know, strategy that exactly like you're saying that he didn't know, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was one thing that came out during the hearing that I feel like is not clear to me, and that is the whole thing where he talked about why he started taking notes immediately after his first meeting. It's not clear to me that he decided that in the meeting with Trump, or if he knew going into the meeting with Trump that he was going to make those notes. And if he knew going into the meeting with Trump that he may want to take notes, I wonder what he knew about Trump going in.
Right.
I mean, he is the head of the FBI, and
right.
And I wonder what relationship the FBI had with Trump before any of this. That's my question, but
that's a good question.
It is a good question. I wouldn't even know who to ask it of. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, and boy,
what are all your middle-aged girlfriends saying about that?
Well, here's the thing. Also, here's my other thing. I want Trump to quit.
I just want him to quit. I want him to quit, like, on Twitter or something. Just be like, I quit, and stamp his foot and leave so that we don't have to go through all the taxpayer dollars of an impeachment process.
Yeah. I don't
know. Think he'll do that?
No. No, I don't. I'm afraid I don't think he'll do that. I think he's going to stick around and just, I think, you know, impeachment, if it comes, is not going to come until 2019. And even then,
right.
Who knows?
It's going to take a long time.
Yeah. I mean, well, you're going to have Democrats in there, and there's no way you're going to have Democrats. The Republican Party is never going to impeach him. You know that, right? The Republican Party is never going to impeach him. And I think, like, it is upsetting to me that you don't know that. Because suggests,
you think I'm too hopeful?
It suggests to me that there are other people out there who don't know that. And I think
there are.
It
there are
is
a ton of
the
dreamers.
Greatest misapprehension of who the Republican Party is to imagine that they would impeach Donald Trump.
Because, well, they'd have to have some morality and they'd have to go. Yeah, I mean, I understand why you're saying that, but I promise you that most of the people that were tuning in yesterday morning were hoping in a uninformed way that something would happen in there and someone would come in and go, that's enough. This is you can, you're fired. Done today.
Yeah, no.
I you know?
While they were doing that, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were tearing down the entire administrative apparatus.
Actually, what
country.
Was happening while that was going on was that they were making sure that kids didn't have inhalers. So they were focused. They were keeping their
yes.
eyes on the ball, Isabel.
Yes. And
Here, Isabel. Here we go. You want to hear what the Republican Party was doing during this? Let's tune in to what Paul Ryan, and remember, Paul Ryan is the smart, wonky guy who is only out
going
to just
straight
make
to hell.
America better. Here's Paul Ryan talking about the Comey testimony.
Look, as far as the conversations and all of that, I'm not going to speculate on any of this. I would just add that, of course, there needs to be a degree of independence between DOJ, FBI, and a White House, and a line of communications established. The president's new at this. He's new to government. And so he probably wasn't steeped in the long-running protocols that establish the relationships between DOJ, FBI, and White Houses. He's just new to this.
What?
So,
is that real?
I mean, I'm
amazing
at
real.
It, but I'm also new at it.
So in other words,
wait,
Isabel.
Who is he talking to?
He's talking to you. He's saying, Isabel, the Republican Party is never going to impeach Donald Trump.
I'm saying, Isabel, I really enjoy your young adult literature. And even if this guy literally rapes and murders a hooker in front of us, not going to happen because I got kids to make poor.
That's what he's telling you. He's telling you that tax cuts uber alles, that there's no way the president, because he hasn't been involved with government, could understand that you're not supposed to tell the guy who's investigating you to shut the investigation down.
Wait a second. Had I known that, totally would have done it.
but then isn't it true that even if that's his own fault that he doesn't know, but it's you're not allowed to do it. It's illegal. So you're fired.
Well,
you have to go to jail now.
Yeah, except for the problem is that the it's not there's no criminal case that you can bring against the president. You can only impeach him. And that means that Paul Ryan, that guy who just said, like, you know, you can't really blame him because he didn't know.
You can't blame him because he didn't know, which everybody knew going in. He didn't know. He's a businessman.
Got it. No, well, but we're told that. By the Republican Party, that the businessman, that's the, we should have the CEO president, right?
I
mean, I don't think you need to be involved in government to know that you can't become president or mayor or any chief executive of any type of governmental entity and then tell the police, hey, you're not allowed to investigate me.
No, by the way, I just went, I swear all 95 eighth graders that I just saw graduate all know that from whatever civics class I just walked out of. Like, I don't think you need to, you know, have been governor or senator to know that very basic principle.
Here's something that I find really sad, okay? Mila grew up with Barack Obama as president. And you know, I was not going to say to Mila, you know, when she was five, look, President Obama did not come through with the bankruptcy cram down like he made a big issue of before the, like, it just wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to say that to my 5-year-old daughter. It wouldn't have stuck with her. Even now, the bank stuff that I tell her about with Obama, I don't.
It's complicated.
But I literally, we are trying to teach Saul that he can't lie. And we've been told by his teachers that you don't say don't lie. You say it's important to tell the truth. Okay? Because he took a little plastic car from school and told us that a cat gave it to him. And and we are finding it effective. We are finding it effective to say to him, don't lie. I mean, you got to tell the truth. You know who doesn't tell the truth? Donald Trump. And I swear to you, he immediately said, I got it from school. And like,
yeah. I stole it.
It's just
because he doesn't want, he instinctually knows he can't model behavior after the president, which is a travesty. That's
right. You
know. I mean, does he still demands all of these total like high school kids from his friends.
Yes. He said, but can we just let it go? Can we just let it go? I mean, can we not?
I'm kind of new to lying.
Right. But
that's the thing, is that with the teenagers, when they lie to you, which is, by the way, a lot.
Yeah. Are your kids lying to you now?
Oh, my God. And let me tell you how obvious it is. It is so obvious that it's like, this is what no one tells you. You know, a lot of people say no one tells you how hard it is. No one tells you how easy it is to see when your kid is lying to you. It is like it's like, you know, picking up, I don't know, just think of the easiest thing in the world, and that's what it's like. It is so obvious. So they lie to you, and you're like, the parenting thing is the same. So tell me the truth, exactly what happened, and you won't get in trouble. Like, okay, this is not what happened, but like, I smoke pot. Okay, let's move on and think about like different things about that. You never would get in trouble for smoking pot if you told the truth that you actually did smoke pot.
Oh, we punished Saul after that.
You did?
Yeah, we wrapped his hands in gauze for he gets his hands wrapped in gauze for 2 days.
A cat gave it to me.
He said a cat literally pushed it with its nose and gave it to him.
It was so weird. A cat gave this to me. The cat, he really pushed it with his nose and he gave it to me. It's true.
I didn't know I wasn't.
It was unbelievable.
To take it from the cat.
Can you imagine? I've never seen anything like that before. It was unbelievable.
No,
it's amazing. And then a dog gave me a soft drink. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I drank a Coke, but a dog made me do it. Yeah.
Hey, Mom, the dog got me high. I don't know how he did it, but that's it.
First, he ate
my
homework.
Friend.
Then
that's
we got
the thing,
high
all
together.
All these lies. And I have it all over the place. This is another thing. Like, so our kids are a little older, so they're watching the news and reading the news and all that stuff. And over again, 3-4 times in a segment, someone's like, well, that's a total lie. These people are lying, and here's 6 reasons why that's true. And you're just like, so it's just nonstop lies that they are learning is okay. It's okay because there's no punishment for it. It's just a fact that it's just lying after lie after lie after lie. Comey said it. That is just a lie. It's a lie that the FBI was in disarray.
Well, he said, and you know, look, people, I don't blame people for being, you know, skeptical sort of generically of the FBI director, but he basically said in the first line of questioning, I went in there and and took notes because I thought there was a very good chance that he would lie about our encounter. I mean, that's just amazing.
It's a pretty safe bet.
That's just amazing.
The whole campaign, he lied and lied and lied and lied.
It's true. It's true. Wow.
Never said Ivanka was hot. Not once. Totally unfair.
How about Ivanka being called the most powerful Jewish woman in the world?
Oh, yeah. There was. Who wrote that up? Was that New York Magazine?
As soon as Jared, goes to jail, the Jew thing is done.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, first of all, she's been Jewish for about a year. Second of all, have you heard of Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Have you heard?
Right.
I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? And then, how about when she came out of whatever it was, like Sukkot or some? She's like, I'm just emerging, getting back online from Sukkot. Wasn't probably good. Just wanted to say, you know, go gay pride. And the gay community freaking took her down. Never have I had so much fun watching comments. It was meme after meme after meme of people just being like, you cannot speak to us. It was like a minute after the Paris agreement pullout.
Yeah, I mean, for someone who is so powerful, like what's she been able to, what's she been able to actually have any impact on?
Nothing. And I don't even believe that she was pro-environment
or
pro-state. And I could believe it as much as I could throw her across the street. You know, honestly, she's...
good at leaking stories about herself and Jared to make them and look decent, which is what they were doing. And people seem to believe...
I don't think they ever looked decent.
I agree with you. Oh, no, of course not. They were awful. But there was a lot of people that were deluded about them. There was a lot of... There were all those stories like, oh, maybe they'll be the ones who hold them in check.
More,
I mean, people bought this hustle.
More hope. Hope. Nonsense, hope. Everybody always will have a hopeful feeling.
Right.
You know, like, because they don't want to... go down.
No, nobody on this show will have a hopeful feeling except for me.
Kelly's
people
the
not
only
hope.
Well, I mean, hope about Jared and Ivanka is not, that's some other word. It's not hope.
No, but it was people like, well, they're
desperation.
They
desperation,
went to,
yeah.
To college, you know.
Yeah, they so, went, his dad bribed his way into Harvard. I'm sure he cares about
right.
people.
Do you know how many,
I mean, I
Michael,
know
I'm so
jail,
sick of you saying that. Do you know how many people that get into Harvard are just there because their legacy is or they pay this and that? I mean,
yeah,
it's not particularly,
not
oh, no,
yeah, it's not. It's definitely
right.
not good, but it's not particularly notable.
Well, actually, kind of is.
Especially not with Harvard. Harvard
no,
with,
well, with like, him specifically, his the amount of $2.5 million, and it's also there's a really good book.
Yeah, if you're really not good enough to get into Harvard,
the legacy,
you buy a library.
It was about the how the Ivy League reinforces inequality. It was like the price of admission, and he was a case study in it in 2005. And one of the great quotes was one of his advisors from a high school in Paramus, New Jersey, was like, and this is a privileged school, was like, there was literally no reason to expect, even by a stretch, that he would get in on any merits, and it's kind of depressing. Like, we don't even have a cover story as to this kid getting in, and everybody goes,
we never,
you went to Harvard. It's such
it's
nonsense.
A systemic problem.
Yeah,
and it's,
which
and
she's
it's...
a great example of, exactly.
But by the way, America, don't go to Harvard for undergraduate anyway. So, I mean, like, that is a
that's true, unless you get...
conception. There's this pyramid with the big H on the top, and it's ridiculous. It's go fine. If you go through some other college and you're like, I'm going to be a doctor or I'm going to be a whatever, I need graduate work, go to Harvard, please. I want that to see that degree when I go into the doctor's office. But undergrad, you don't have to go to Harvard for undergrad. It's a very weird road that leads to Harvard. This
well, how
now,
else? But if you want
to
write, if you want
to
write sitcoms.
It's a given.
If you want to write sitcoms, great place to go.
What
now you're
you
just
want,
speaking
what,
to the fact that it's a given that people go to undergrad, though, which is...
huge number of people who are in the sitcom writing world.
But what if you want to help prop up your father's real estate empire and then help smuggle money for your father-in-law? Harvard would help.
In Franken's Al Franken's book, apparently, the fact that he went to Harvard... it was a positive that negated people's perception of him, the negative perception they had of him because he was a comedian. So
when
they
ran
found
for Senate, really?
Yes, they found in focus groups that if he mentioned that he went to Harvard, it helped him.
Well, of course.
Well, that
no,
for sure.
Not of course.
Like,
oh, that's surprising,
branding
actually.
Of all world.
Well,
the whole
for
world
Senate.
Is-
I mean, he was surprised by it, and I think, you know, because there's a lot of context where that creates a certain amount of resentment. And
well, it balances the you're not a serious person out
that's
with,
what
oh, well, maybe
out.
You
that's
are
a
serious
point.
Person.
I went
yeah.
to Wharton.
Well,
also, people zip it when they say, when you're, you know, when they hear Harvard, they're like, oh, okay, well... Because even if you got in because you paid for it, you still had to get through the class.
I think it's good to talk about these universities and the complete failures that they produce, not just the really good people. So, like, Trump went to Wharton. I think that should, people should continue to mention that because it proves that someone like Trump can go to Wharton and graduate.
And also these places, but especially Harvard, is notorious for grade inflation. So it's like as soon as – I mean, and I have plenty of friends who went there, and it's like the joke was is like the terror was getting in. Especially if, you know, you couldn't be bribed in like Jared. And then getting in is a Herculean task. And then once you're there, I mean, first of all, it's like Isabel's saying. It's like going to any top liberal arts school. Of course, you have to read, you have to write papers. But, like, you really have to stretch to get lower than a B.
You know, in Hollywood, I found that there was a lot of, like, I would go in, have meetings with the writers, you know, executive producers of shows, because you take these general meetings, and they're like, and this was, you know, I was just a year or two out of Boston, and they're like, where did you come from? And I said, well, I was in New York briefly, but basically I've just come from Boston. Oh, yeah? Where did you live? I lived in Cambridge. Oh, I was in Cambridge, too, for 4 years. And I'm like, oh. Where did you live? Well, Harvard dorms. You know, they everybody just like sort of signals that they went to Harvard because they don't want everybody to know. It, you know, because there was a real pipeline from the National Lampoon, like Conan, you know, the...
Oh, yeah, and all that hasty pudding or whatever.
Yes, but did I say National Lampoon? Harvard Lampoon, rather.
You mean the Harvard, you mean...
Harvard Lampoon, and they had their own. Wait, what was it? They have their own like little special house there. I was invited.
Jared's dad bought it, and he became the editor of the Harvard Lampoon.
Is that right?
No, it's not right. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I bought my sense of humor.
When I lived in Cambridge, when my ex-husband taught at Harvard, and I never went to Harvard because we lived actually near MIT. We lived. Farther away.
I didn't know you lived in Cambridge. Where?
I did. I lived on Hamilton Street, which is in sort of towards the river from MIT. So it's where Ben Affleck's parents, I think, lived. That's what I, anyway, it was far away from Harvard. And I wrote this in my book. I was like, this is a bunch of frumpy pilgrims. I can't deal. I didn't like Cambridge. I was always cold. I just didn't like of city very much. And but one day I went to bring a sandwich or something to my ex-husband who was teaching, and I walked into Harvard Yard and I was like, oh, like, this is why everyone, okay, it was like red brick buildings and a lawn and everybody's talking, and you know, I was like, all right. And then I didn't really go back that much. But anyway, whatever. How did we get on Harvard?
Well, I didn't know. You know, I lived on Pearl Street.
Oh, that's right where we lived. You know what garage is on Pearl Street, I believe? It's actually
no.
In Hamilton, but I think it's the garage. Remember two garage guys on NPR?
Click and Clack?
Yeah, yeah. The people who talked about your car.
Click and Clack.
Call in and be like, yeah, that was the garage. I was on that street.
I had no idea. I was on Pearl Street, but I was way closer to Central Square, and in a like a three-quarter way house above a laundromat.
Yeah, I basically was too.
Oh my God! Yeah, you were down in Cambridgeport. That is not the nicest.
Not the fancy part.
No,
not the fancy part.
I mean, now I bet it's really sort of
now it is.
It's changed, but
now it is. But 15 years ago, it was pretty.
Yeah, no, that was a good place to be, like, when you were in your 20s and you want to go see rock music. But I don't know that I would...
I was pregnant. I had a baby.
Yeah, that's not. Well, I wouldn't want to be pregnant there. It would be awkward.
So.
What do you got for us, Isabel? What should we watch will take us out of this for just a moment? This sort of national malaise that we're in.
I know. Hold on. I'm trying to get it on speakerphone. It's hard to get out of the malaise, which is why.
Wait, what are you doing? Hold on. Wait. Where are you going?
I can't get it on speakerphone.
Why? Why do you need to get it on speakerphone? Are you all right?
Yeah, because I could. Yeah. Okay. There we go. Okay. Are you there?
Yeah. What?
All right. So, haven't been going out to the movies much. There was.
Wait, are you going somewhere? What are you doing? Why are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm just.
Are you getting drugs?
For a second.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, because you're looking it up on your phone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm looking. Mm. I want to get the exact person who produces this because I can't remember. It's on Netflix. Oh yeah. Okay. It's on Netflix. We've gone to Comedy Land in our house.
Oh, to cheer yourselves up a little bit. Okay.
Yes. I think it's sort of political. The kids are watching a lot of political, sort of John Oliver, you know, that kind of shows, because I think it's a way to, immersion therapy or something. Like, okay, this is terrifying and everybody seems to be scared and parents don't seem to say it's going to be okay, but it's the truth. It is the reality that this is our president, but someone is going to make us laugh about it. And that person is ABCD, whoever, all those people.
I see. I mean, it's sort of like they tell you if you have like a sweating problem to go into a an interview. No, to go into an interview and try and sweat as much as you can as a way of dealing with it. That's what I've heard.
Right. Well, it's like can't beat him, join him, kind of. You know, just like get into it. Like face the lion. But having someone who's making you laugh, and because they're teenagers, comedians really make them laugh. You know that it's this beautiful part of watching someone grow up where for a long time they're friends and you're the only people that make them laugh. But suddenly another source comes in and makes them laugh so hard that it's like watching, I don't know. It's like watching them grow an inch or something. You're like, what? like they hit their funny bones and they laugh and the tears are coming down and you're like, oh my gosh, thanks. You know,
who is it? What is it? What are they watching?
Okay. So the one I'm going to recommend is on Netflix. It just came on Netflix. And it's Hasan Minhaj. His
who?
Hasan Minhaj.
I've never heard of this guy.
He was a correspondent on John Stewart.
I never heard of him.
You haven't?
Hasan Minhaj?
Hasan Minhaj. Hasan H-A-N. S-A-N,
okay.
M-I-N-H-A-J.
Okay, yeah, I got
and
him.
He was the guy who did the White House Correspondents' Dinner this year.
I got the same recommendation from somebody just the other day. It was a very strong recommendation, yes. Very strong recommendation, so.
Thanks for the support, Kelly. So here's what's fun about him. Interesting about his show. It's not just a comedy. I mean, it is comedy, but he does something I've never seen a comedian do. He brings in his personal story, but and then goes deep and sort of doesn't stay on the comedy surface. He kind of goes deep, and it's he breaks the fourth wall. It's a very interesting.
What's the name of the show?
It's called. That's why I was trying to put you on. It's on Netflix, and it's called, hold on.
It's not Homecoming King, is it?
Yeah.
Is it that a special, or is that a one-off?
It's a one-off on Netflix, but it's like an hour long, so it's good to watch, and you can watch it with the kids, too, because it's about him growing up, and he's from India, and he's
his parents immigrated and had him. Actually, he didn't immigrate. They had him.
He's an anchor baby.
Yeah. Is that where that is? When?
Wait, that's that? Yeah. It's very, hello?
Hello? Do you keep getting on and off your speakerphone? What are you doing?
Because I had to make sure it's okay. On Netflix. And it's an hour, and I think it's a good. It's like here we are on Friday. It's Good Times Friday. Like maybe grabs like a ginger ale or something refreshing, a margarita, and watch this. You can watch it with your whole family. He's really funny about siblings. He's so funny about siblings because he's a first sibling, and then he had a younger sister. Mm-hmm. He has a younger sister, and so that's a really good dynamic. He talks a lot about cultural identity. He talks a lot about race. He talks a lot about not so much politics, but race and what that's like growing up. And he did talk about what it was like being in his town after 9/11. It's there's some heavy stuff there, but it's poignant. And I think he's one to watch. I think that is a good way to spend an hour. That's my recommendation.
I like it. All right. Bingo. Yeah.
Bingo. Easy. Even Saul can watch it.
Really?
Hasan Minhaj.
Okay. I got it. We will put that.
It's on Netflix, and he's funny and quite poignant. And, made everybody in our families, all five of us watched it, made us all think. We had a good discussion afterwards about it. And Bob's your uncle.
And Bob's my uncle?
That's an English, I'm an Anglophile. Anglophile.
And that's what is that, an English?
Yeah. It's like saying, and so there we go. Bob's your uncle.
No, I had no idea. I've never heard that phrase at all.
So here's what I have to say. Maybe Hasan Minhaj will jolt us into it. I'm wondering if we can all ask ourselves how we're going to have fun in June like we did when we were teenagers, like those kids in the car. That's my – I'm headed out to California this weekend.
Wow.
And I'm going to try and see if I can let the
– Is this for the book or to visit friends?
For Peter's work. I'm going – it's for my husband's job. I got to go to something out there.
Sounds good, I think.
Well, it is what it is,
I know.
Just tell your kids that they need to solve their own problems for like a week, and then you can only think about yourself, and that's what it's like to be a teenager.
But is that really what you do? Because that's what everybody says you do. You guys, it's like, it's up to you. I mean, maybe that's empowering for them.
Oh, don't take parenting advice from me. I have no kids, and I'm also
Kelly just thinks they're all on drugs.
No, I don't know. Isabel would know if her kids were on drugs, I think.
You'd think. Yeah. You'd hope. But you don't know.
Oh, my parents knew. They were no fools. They knew, like,
the
first time. My dad?
That's what I'm saying about the teenagers not being able... Yeah, your dad's the coolest guy in the world. That's what I'm saying about teenagers not being able to lie. You can't lie.
I got caught doing every single thing. The only time I got away with lies was when they were just like tired.
Someday,
my parents were too tired to like argue about it.
That's true. That's true. After a while, you're just like, oh, all right, take your vape and go do whatever.
Right, and then couple of times. I mean, after catching me smoking weed for the 20th time, they would just take it, put it in this drawer, and I knew where the drawer was, and then I would go take it back. And it was just like they were bored.
Drawer.
They were just bored.
All right. Well,
it's boring.
Well, we're gonna do the whole drug story.
That is true.
Jimmy Sullivan. I'll tell you the whole Jimmy
That's
Sullivan
classic.
Story one day.
Jimmy Sullivan is classic.
But
all right, well, listen, don't let it be 6 weeks again, because there's a lot to discuss in this world.
I know. Isabel, want to catch up with what's going on with your book, too. But
I'm good on that. I'm good on that. That's in a good lane. Last time I was a little lost in the ocean. Now I'm in my lane, and I got it, and it'll be done by September.
All right, good. Well, you can catch us up. All right, Isabel, thank you so much. We'll watch that thing. Hasan Minhaj. We got it.
Please do. Please do, and tweet to me if you did it.
All right, great.
And everybody else watch him, too.
Isabel Gillies, ladies and gentlemen.
Take care. Enjoy California.
Bye.
All right, folks.
Bye. Have a good weekend.
Bye. All right, folks. Going to head to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the show. Also, it's your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member of the Majority Report, you not only become a member of the Majority Report, but you support this show. You support the free show. And as a bonus, as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. So please, if you have the means, join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy stuff from Amazon or you buy stuff from jet.com, remember majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Every time you buy through our link, which you can save in any way that you deem most convenient, we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. We'll be right back with the fun half.
No, things are looking bad.